Hello, and welcome to episode 17 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. Today we present part one of a conversation we had with our friend John Lundberg as we wrestle with conversations about race and whiteness. So what's been a highlight for you this week?
Well, one little minor highlight, and it feels a little weird even saying it now. You know, you and I out at Crown have been down the same hallway for some time now. Mm-hmm. And so we've not shared an office space, but our offices have been close together. And I've liked that. I like kind of being down. You know, for our listeners who don't know the situation, it's a little bit of a more quiet hallway. Mm-hmm. And it's been nice kind of being in a similar area as you and as some of the other profs that I'm close with out at Crown. But I finally moved offices this week. You know, we saw you out there.
Yeah.
It was a little bittersweet in some ways, but it was nice. I think it'll be a nice office. So it was kind of a highlight, I guess.
Nice. Yeah.
At least I get a closet, you know. I mean, this is like first world things right here where you're talking about privilege and all that kind of stuff, you know, saying that moving offices is a highlight feels weird to me.
You know, but you got room for a lot of books in the new office, which is nice.
There's that. There's more room for books in a bigger desk and more space in there.
Yeah.
It's going to be in a little more, busy area, but that's okay. You know, seeing students isn't a bad thing. So
I think the students will be really happy you're over there. Yeah.
Yeah, it'll be all right. You know, I do have to admit though, that some of my decision to finally move over there was slightly motivated by the fact that I know that you're scaling back in your role.
Right.
And so I probably won't be seeing you on campus as much. Yeah. So, you know, so I kind of thought, well, maybe now's the time, I guess, to go into the big area.
Yeah. Well, now you've made it into where the real professors are, right?
Oh boy. Yeah, I guess. How about for you? What was the highlight?
Raspberries. I love raspberries. And where you live, like Hopkins, it's known for raspberries, right? It has the big raspberry on the water tower.
Yeah, and we currently have the largest raspberry in the world in Hopkins. Now, it's not a real raspberry. It's a big statue.
That's funny.
It's about, I don't know, five blocks from my house, right next to a brewery there in downtown Hopkins. But yeah, Hopkins was known as kind of like I don't know if they call themselves the raspberry capital of the world, but one of our neighbors was just saying, you know, that they met somebody who came to Hopkins and was like, well, where are the raspberries? And the kind of the joke is, you know, well, go down all the alleys and you'll find these plants just kind of growing on the alleys of the avenues, you know. And that's funny because we have some raspberries in the avenues in the avenue. So yeah.
Yesterday I stood out. We've got a raspberry patch that we've planted and I just stood out back and just picked raspberries and ate them off the canes yesterday. And I just love fresh raspberries. Anyway.
They are great, aren't they? What about a low light for you?
It has to be that I got injured. Uh-huh. I ended up hurting my hand and actually cut a tendon in my hand. And
oh man!
So I have surgery this coming week. Yeah. I don't have full utility of my middle finger, and which means it's splinted, which means I have to be careful waving at people because it's kind of, you know.
Yeah.
But it had me thinking about when we were talking with Victoria a few weeks ago, I mentioned the idea of being temporarily abled and that you never know when you might lose some ability.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that's been fascinating is all the things I suddenly can't do.
Yeah.
Or that I have to relearn how to do. And, you know, I mean, this is a relatively minor thing, but it's so disruptive. And just thinking about how much I assume my ableness, right?
And that affects you. I mean, the kind of work that we do requires a lot of typing, right? Requires being on the computer.
I took a word per minute test because I was really curious because I've got my middle finger splinted up, you know, but I at least for now have access to my other four fingers on the hand. And I was at 45 words a minute. So I was like, okay, well.
With the splint.
Yeah. Wow. Anyway.
Man, that's pretty impressive.
How about for you? What's a low light been?
Well, maybe I'll continue with the theme. Then you're talking about just health and issues surrounding that. I found out this week some terrible news, which was that three folks that we used to go to church with in St. Paul died recently.
Oh, no.
And two of them seemed to be COVID related. Mm. And the church community that we were going to was a very small community, 12 to 15 people, mostly folks who are probably in their 70s or older. Mm-hmm. And one of the couples who I got to know the best, actually, I know John, he ended up having some health issues and like leukemia, but I just found out that he died like 6 weeks ago of COVID.
Oh my.
And then just heard that his wife passed away this last week. and I didn't hear any news as to exactly why, but another member of the church passed away due to some COVID complications. He got it and then got better, but then ended up passing away because it took such a toll on his body. And it's sobering. I hadn't seen them in a little while. You know, we hadn't been going to church there right before the COVID stuff had hit because we started going to a different church. But then with all the COVID stuff, I hadn't talked to them in a little while. So that was just some awful news to hear.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it put some perspective for me into some of the COVID discussions that are happening where there are a lot of folks, I think, who are around our age who will say things like, well, you know, it's not that much of a risk for us. And, you know, there's not many people our age that are dying and things like that. And I think it's just sometimes terribly insensitive when you consider the fact that there are people who we know and people who we love who are older than we are who are dying of it. And I don't want to take that lightly.
Yeah.
So there's that health issue. And then having some health issues myself, I've had this problem over the years where my heart's kind of raced or had these heavy beats. And so I had to go back in and get that looked at. So I'm currently wearing a heart monitor that I have to have on for 2 weeks.
Gotcha. Oh, yeah.
So they kind of patch that thing on and it, you're supposed to kind of push the button when you feel some things. But anyhow, I'm kind of just waiting to hear back on that. So I'm in the similar vein here in terms of some of your thoughts about temporary ableness. Is that what you called it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And just thinking about you just kind of never really know, even if things seem to be going just fine, where that can take a turn. Mm-hmm. I even thought about earlier in the semester. See, it shows how I think of time. Early in the semester. Earlier in the year, Jill and I both got really sick. One evening I was fine. And then 3 hours later, I was really sick.
And that's something.
Yeah. And so it's like, you just can take for granted sometimes that, oh, I feel fine today. And then it's only 24 hours before something can hit.
Yeah. Know? What's an insight been for you this week?
Completely unrelated to what I was just talking about. But, you know, I was looking into some of the things that we talked about with Mark a couple of weeks ago. And something that really interested me was looking more into the history of Minnesota, especially as it relates to the Dakota people.
Right.
And knowing that there is a long history of some conflicts between the United States government or the Minnesota local government as well and the Dakota people. And there's just some sobering things I found. I found this really interesting article actually from a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. Her name's Carol Chomsky, and she wrote a pretty long, extensive article about the conflict between the Dakota folks and the U.S. government in 1865. And there's just some really bad things that Minnesota governors were saying about the Dakota people. One thing that I didn't realize at the time was that one of the main people that was in charge of squashing sort of the Dakota conflict was Henry Sibley. And Henry Sibley was the first governor of Minnesota.
Oh, is that right?
And what was interesting is he was the first governor. And then when he finished being governor, he went and he ended up becoming part of this militia to help serve in the Civil War. But he was also in charge basically of squashing any sorts of conflicts with the Dakota. And he made some pretty rough comments about the need to exterminate the Dakota people.
Wow.
And that was actually just piggybacking off the current governor at the time, Alexander Ramsey, who had said that basically to the Minnesota Congress. So in September of 1862, he had recommended to Congress that the Dakota people either be entirely removed from Minnesota or be exterminated entirely. Mm-hmm. Stuff like that. I mean, I've lived in Minnesota my whole life. I've known just little bits about some of that, but I never really knew the extent of it. And reading it from a really well-written and well-researched article here from this professor from the University of Minnesota made it even more sobering, I think, as she does some extensive research into those conflicts. So I don't know what insight there is there, except to say that like brought to light some of the things I think that Mark was talking about that really matter in terms of thinking about history. And for me, thinking about local history, something that, like I say, I mean, this is in my backyard, you know, these kinds of things have happened. A couple of the major battlefields actually in the Dakota conflict were about, I want to say a stone's throw, but not literally a stone's throw, but not far from Crown College.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, just west of Crown. So yeah, it's something I've just been reflecting on. How about for you?
I've been a little all over the place this week. Part of it is the injury, right? Just shakes everything up. I think something that I've been thinking about this week, I saw somebody else had reflected on this thought that we are already moving away from a lot of the conversation around race, which you kind of know that's what happens, right? It kind of ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
And now, you know, a lot of conversation about COVID and less conversation about race. Both are still happening. But yeah, I don't know. I think this question of how do you, on the one hand, be open to, you know, what is the conversation? What is the thing that we need to be talking about right now? Mm-hmm. And then also be stable about the things that, even though they kind of fall off the radar, are still really important and worth talking about.
Yeah.
And it, worth talking about makes it maybe too minimizing of it. It's like,
yeah,
it's been a little over a month and a half since George Floyd was killed. And yeah, I see people still saying, hey, we need to pay attention to what happened to Breonna Taylor, right? Somehow I feel like currently the louder voices right now are the voices saying, hey, let's not pay so much attention to this. They're kind of like the anti-Black Lives Matter voices. And somehow the pro voices, the ones that are saying, hey, we need to be paying attention to this. Hey, it's not resolved. I don't know where they've gone. I suspect that the people are still talking, right?
Yeah.
But at least in my feeds that I see in the news, I'm seeing less of it. And so I think a few things there. One is just wondering, okay, what is actually driving that media cycle? And then the other is thinking about, how do I have some stability in the things that matter when the larger conversation moves on? If you remember back when we found out about Ahmaud Arbery, that was one of the things that I had said at that point was, I hope that people that are starting to recognize that this stuff matters, I hope that they mean it. Because I feel like sometimes these things are like a flash in the pan. And maybe I'm misperceiving this week. I could be, you know, off because I'm so busy thinking about my middle finger. But anyway.
Well, it's interesting because I know that the state, at least, because, you know, my wife is a state employee, I know that they've been taking some measures actually to do some training around the concepts of like anti-racism and challenging racism systemically. And I thought that was quite interesting to know that they've got some pretty sustained training efforts in place. When I feel like a lot of organizations, there's been some radio silence from.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I just thought it was an interesting observation. I think, you know, there's certainly more pressure for the state government to do so because of the relationship to what happened with the George Floyd incident and, and the state's response to it and everything. But I'm a little bit disheartened to know that other organizations are not feeling maybe as inclined to have to be considering things like that. At least that seems to be the case.
Right. Well, somebody who is thinking about that kind of stuff is here with us. Nice. I think he's just joining in.
Cool.
There he is.
Boys.
Hey,
how's it going, John?
Not too shabby. Oh, hey, in pandemic season, it's just good to be seen too, right?
Seriously. Well, it's a pleasure to have John Lumberg with us here today. We're going to have, I think, an interesting conversation. John, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. My name is John Lumberg. I grew up in Crystal, Minnesota, just in the western suburbs over here, and, you know, predominantly white environment. And, you know, played basketball with some guys in junior high, high school that were people of color. But then that was about the extent of it. Had a couple of Asian families that lived on our block that contributed to kind of some of my awareness of today's subjects. But I ended up going to Bethel College, not Bethel University. But I graduated from Bethel with a biblical theological studies degree and youth ministry degree because they weren't that different. And ended up moving to Jackson, Mississippi for a few years after college, working for a man named John Perkins for a number of years, who became, I mean, my mentor slash hero. His wife was my grandma, took care of me while I was down there, made meals and would call me up at the office and say, come on, make you a plate. Came up, single, bachelor, young 20s.
This is John.
John M. Perkins.
He's the grandfather of John P. Perkins, yes. Who we had on the show a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. And that, I like to kind of, I talk about that period of my life as being John M. Perkins ruined my life in the best possible way, opening my eyes to a lot of things that I just was not equipped to see until that point. Moved back after that, met my wife in Minneapolis. We moved out to Idaho for a year just to kind of have a year-long kind of honeymoon, work some jobs, and be married in the mountains. And then got the call back here to work for an organization called Urban Homeworks. Moved into North Minneapolis 14 years ago, and we've lived Northside for 14 years now. And, you know, experience all of the wonderful highs of that and all of the challenging lows of that as well. I think anywhere. I mean, we talk about the uptick in violence, especially in the last few months. due to a lot of things that we'll probably get into later. And we recognize, though, too, that we're living with a physical threat and physical violence around us. But wherever we would move, because of what we know and because of a lot of the subjects we're going to get into today, there are other kinds of violence that we would be subject to if we lived elsewhere, where there wasn't necessarily a threat to my physical safety. There is, I believe, a threat to spiritual safety, a threat to mental and emotional safety, based on the things that we have the opportunity to encounter every day. And my kids have the opportunity to counter it, that some of their cousins and friends don't. Yeah, we've lived here. I recently left Urban Homeworks, you know, on really, really great terms. And I now am employed by the Shakopee Mattawakutan Sioux community tribe down in Shakopee, Minnesota. So yeah, employed by the tribe and report to the tribe and working in a sovereign nation, essentially. And so it's awesome. I absolutely love it.
That's interesting, John, because we were just before you got on talking about a guest that we had on the show a couple of weeks ago who was running for president, named Mark Charles. Oh,
yeah. Mark Charles, good dude.
Yeah, so you know Mark. So it was interesting because I was doing some research into some of the Dakota conflicts in Minnesota and certainly related to Shakopee. And it's a pretty sobering part of Minnesota history, to say the least.
There's a lot that's loaded.
Well, maybe that's a conversation for another time, but... See, I'd be super interested. I feel a little bit ashamed for forgetting that your connection with Dr. Perkins. It'd be interesting to hear just a little bit. How'd you get set up down there with Dr. Perkins? What led you to go down there? And what were some of the things that were so eye-opening to you when you got there and as you lived there with Dr. Perkins?
Yeah, I want to preface by saying, too, is that we've had a lot of conversations about the idea of, especially a lot of white folks, having the idea of colorblindness, right, be kind of preeminent in this discussion of discovering whiteness, discovering culture, discovering these things. And like, well, I don't see color. I teach my kids to, you know, see everybody as the same. And okay, yeah, there's some decent intention there, but right there, that can be destructive for many reasons. But I do credit my parents, especially my mom, in pushing us our entire childhood to treat everyone the same. Doesn't matter where they're from, doesn't matter what language they speak. Like I said, one of my best friends growing up was Vietnamese. He was across the street. One of my mom's best friend was a Korean sister that lived next door. And there was always this emphasis to treat everybody the same. We had one of my favorite neighbors growing up because he had a sweet old black Cadillac was Carl. And Carl was in a wheelchair. And mom was reinforcing all the time too, like, Carl doesn't get treated differently. And so there really was a bedrock that I feel that my parents set me up with that allowed a lot of these conversations around whiteness, around intercultural competency to make more sense. But yeah, I remember one of my best friends was down in Mississippi with Dr. Perkins, living kind of on the campus, but working through AmeriCorps for Habitat, brought him up to his alma mater at Southwest State. And I just wanted to go see my friend. So I was like, I'm going to come down and visit. He was bringing John Perkins up and I had read one of his books in school. And so knew of him a little bit, knew some of the story, and ended up meeting him in a room on campus. And he came up to me and I was just like, oh, Dr. Perkins, you know, it's a pleasure to meet you. And he just said, first thing, hey guy, come on down to work for me. I was like, what? Like, and then, you know, I tried to be, I guess, polite and, oh, it's okay. How are you? Like, you try to change the subject effectively. Yeah. And he pushed it a couple of times while I was down there, but I was like, he's not serious. Sure enough, like 2 weeks later, he woke me up because he wakes up early. My roommate came in, said, hey, you have a phone call. It's John Perkins. And I was like, what? So I get on the phone. He's like, when are you going to come down and check it out to see if this is something you want to do? What? And I was just in this tired stupor enough to be like, I guess I could maybe like a couple weeks, like fly down. And he's like, all right, good. Send me the date and we'll make it happen. We'll come get you. Okay. So like I booked a flight and flew down and stayed in the Antioch House right in West Jackson for a couple of nights and just kind of walked around and met some of the other staff and talked with him. And he outlined what he wanted me to do. And I still, I mean, aside from some of the work of the Holy Spirit and God's work in my heart, like I still really don't have an answer for how I ended up there. It really was just, all right, well, I guess I could go. So I ended up like a month and a half later, packing everything in my car and rolling down to Jackson, Mississippi, and spent the next few years there. Mm.
Is this right after college?
This was a year after.
Okay.
And actually a month into working down there, he and I were in a house that we were demoing some walls out of. And I just decided to ask him because I would, you know, I was a very spiritual person and I expected a very spiritual answer. Mm. And I said, what on earth led you to just extend your hand to me and say, come work for me? And my buddy had been talking to him on the plane on the way up. And the only thing he said, even in my memory that I can recall, he said, well, it didn't seem like you had anything better to do.
That's funny.
Which wasn't entirely untrue. I was waiting tables at Timber Lodge Steakhouse with my Bible degree. But just kind of him, too. He saw an opportunity for somebody to come down and that could be a part of it. And I was, you know, kind of next in line of the decades of college educated northern white dudes that decided they were just going to go down there and work with him for a year, two, three. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of this a holy fraternity of us that still many of us are still in contact, ones that came before me and ones that came after me, because we all recognize the incredibly profound work that he was doing in the community, but also that he did in us. By putting up with us, by coaching us, by mentoring us, guiding us, firing us. And my roommate got fired at least every 2 or 3 months. Come home and slam the door. JB fired me again.
That's funny.
I never got fired because I think I just sort of like, all right, just do what I'm told and move on. Yeah.
How long were you there?
I was there a little over 3 years.
Okay. And so something I've heard you talk a little bit about is your understanding of what it means to be white. As you were there, was that kind of a time where you kind of discovered your own whiteness or what was that like?
I think the first time I ever discovered whiteness was in high school when I did a mission trip with friends to from church to Jamaica. Mm. And we were in Kingston, Jamaica. And I never felt that white because there are zero white people in Kingston, Jamaica. And so that was kind of the weird feeling like, oh, it's a big world and I am just a small part of it. And I am in no way a majority in a lot of places. And I always recall two specific conversations that really helped form my idea of whiteness as it pertains to the greater context of society. And one was a brother of mine in Mississippi who I was kind of the volunteer manager for the foundation. I would manage volunteers that would come in and do the work. And our kind of sister partner ministry, Voice of Calvary Ministries, also had a volunteer ministry and organization. And their volunteer coordinator manager was African-American brother who became a brother. I mean, a very legit brother as we worked together, as we ministered together, as we ate together. And we were having a conversation one day, and it was, I feel like a conversation that many young white people have, even if it's in college or after, because we're struggling with some of the identities that we have, or at least we're hearing a lot of belief systems that, I don't know if I believe in that, but I don't necessarily know why, or because I don't understand it. And one of the things that I pointed out to him is like, I don't get this whole white privilege thing, which is obviously inextricably tied to whiteness in general. Mm-hmm. And I said, my mom has told us stories of how, you know, she would go to the grocery store and she would, you know, not be able to afford fruit because fruit was expensive. And like it would bring her to tears because, you know, we couldn't afford certain things growing up that many other people had. And so I was like, I didn't have anything. We were sort of poor. Like I didn't feel privileged in any way because obviously my brain is going to the economics of white privilege specifically, right, and not all of the other societal things. And Pete just, God bless him, graciously came alongside me and started to point out, hey, when you walk out your door in the morning, do you think about the fact that you're white? And I was like, no. It's like when you walk into Target, do you think about the fact that you're white? And I was like, no. Like when you're walking around or when you're driving down the street, are you confronted in any way with the fact that you're white? And I was like, no, that's dumb. Oh, okay. Right. So then he asked me like 8 of those questions and it didn't sink in. Right. Like, I'm just like, no, of course not. Nobody does. Oh, okay. And he started to, you know, tell the stories. When I walk out my door in the morning, I'm confronted everywhere with the fact that I'm black. When I walk into Target, based on the looks that I get and who follows me around, I'm confronted with the fact that I'm Black. When I drive down the street and get pulled over, or people are looking at me, when I'm walking down the sidewalk and people cross the street, I'm confronted with the fact everywhere. When I look at a magazine rack, I'm confronted with the fact that I'm Black. He said, it has nothing to do with economics. It has everything to do with just normalcy. In society, you're normal and I'm not, and you don't have to think about it. And that is the privilege. So then that went down kind of the whiteness stage. And then it was cemented theologically for me one morning when I was sitting. John Perkins had a 5:30 morning Bible study every Wednesday.
That's just his thing, right? Like, it's
that's his thing. I mean, and he's already been up for an hour and a half.
Just that you want to be doing at 5:30 in the morning, getting into these deep conversations about the meaning of the scriptures.
I was ill-equipped at best to have a conversation. But, you know, we'd get there at 5:30 in the morning and he'd be like, I was reading a book this morning. And I was like, what? Already this morning, he read a book. This Bible study, the way that we would do it is we would start a book of the Bible. And we would open it up and we would start reading. And when something hit somebody, we would stop. That person would kind of go, whoa, this just hit me for first time or differently. Or I just saw this. And then we would kind of discuss it for a while until we were done discussing it. And then we would move on. Sometimes we get through like four verses. Sometimes we get through like four chapters. One morning in particular, we were working our way through Matthew and we had gotten through the kind of Passion Week, right? Mm-hmm. Holy Week. And we got to the end where Jesus is crucified. And there were a couple of us younger, white, northern, college educated, middle class, suburban guys. And there were three men, African-American men, including John Perkins, who had lived through the civil rights movement in rural Mississippi, which, whoa, talk about some stories, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And one of these brothers looks at specifically the two of us young white dudes and says, you see what's happening here, right? And I was like, I knew the answer was going to be no. But the theological brain in me, like, oh, I just graduated with a theology degree. Yes, I know what's going on here. If you want to know some of the hermeneutics and all of this, like, I'll let you know what the Greek term for XYZ. But I knew enough to say, like, please tell me. And he said, they all came out with their torches and their pitchforks and they came, they got him at midnight, right? And there's no one else around, no one to cause a fuss, no one to defend him. They falsely accused him. They arrested him under false pretense. They kind of paid some folks to make up some claims and make up some lies. And then they put it on a sham of a trial where people were lying about him. Then they beat him to within an inch of his life. And then they drug him through the street and they hung him from a tree. They lynched him. And I think at that moment, the previous conversations about white privilege, the fact that looking around my neighborhood, I already was confronted with the fact that I was super white just because I was the only white dude. Those conversations all of a sudden became real in the sense that even now theologically, I've never felt so white because I've never seen that story like that because I'm white. Mm-hmm. And because of where I come from, I couldn't have. Because I had not experienced my father, my uncle, my cousin being dragged out in the middle of the night by men with torches, being falsely accused, being dragged through the street, and being hung from a tree. I'd never experienced that in my family mm-hmm. Or any time in my history since coming to America. And so the whiteness became bigger than a societal thing, bigger than an economic thing, bigger than a political thing. It became a spiritual thing and it became a theological thing and forced me then to continue to grapple with what books am I reading? Who's writing those books that I'm reading? Have I kind of gone through the cultural perspective or cultural spectrum when it comes to authors that I'm even listening to, pastors that I'm listening to? And that's part of the reason why I say like John Perkins ruined my life in the best possible way, because he went back into the scriptures and was theologically solid, but also had an incredible perspective that I'd never been party to.
When you were going through that, did that process kind of frustrate you when you thought back about your education in college? Like, were you upset that you never got some of that from your professors?
I think initially, yeah. Initially, there's kind of the stages of grief a little bit, right, too, where I go through anger. Like, how come nobody else ever taught me that? How come nobody else ever said that? And going back and looking at my library even of textbooks and biblical commentaries and all these things and looking up who these authors were and going, whoa, this is very limited, small section of the pie when it comes to worldwide theology about everything. And so I think there was an initial anger. I think it only subsided when I started to realize that you can't know what you don't know, right? And not everybody has the wherewithal or the ability to change locations and to put themselves into proximity to people that would have these answers and don't even know that they should, because no one's ever told them that they should. I'd work myself through some forgiveness and some grace there too, because people had grace with me through this whole process. And so how do I now begin to have grace and love, but also begin to push the envelope of some of those people that did feed me all of those things and try to open those doors.
Sounds like over the course of a few years, it's like there was a new way of seeing everything, and everything from, like you said, walking out the door in the morning to when you open the book of Matthew, what are you seeing? Like, there's just something that you hadn't even known existed, right? Your whiteness was now something you were seeing everywhere. Is that right?
Yeah. And I often use the analogy, and I wish I could give someone credit for this analogy because it's not mine, but I heard it somewhere, but I don't know where, is the analogy of like the fish in water, right? Whiteness is the water in which we swim. There's two young fish and they're swimming along in the lake or in the river, in the ocean. And the old fish comes by and says, how's the water today, fellas? They look at each other like, what's water? Only reason the old fish knows that there's water is dude got caught, right? And he's in the boat. He gets pulled out of the water in the boat going, oh, okay. Yeah, that's important. And I need that. And I swim in it. And it's the air we breathe. It's the water in which we swim. But then once you get caught and exposed to those things, it does cause us to look back at it more constructively and recognize that it is a thing.
Marshall McLuhan, by the way, I think is the one who came up with that.
There you go. Yeah. Credit. but it's that powerful analogy, like, oh yeah, we don't see it because it's normal. It's all around us. Then when you start to notice it, you start to kind of see how destructive it can be. I mean, looking back in history, recognizing that, I mean, for the three of us, it's been super helpful. We've had a pretty great run for a really long time because of it. And even I remember Pete and I, my brother in Mississippi, going out to different restaurants. And because one of the languages we shared in common was food.
There you go.
We were both big foodies. Mm-hmm. And at that point in our lives, early 20s, could really pack it away. So, I mean, we're going to the spaces that are not skimping on portions. And I noticed how servers would speak to me and how servers would speak to him. And I noticed when they came to the table, they would automatically come to me first. Mm-hmm. They would make eye contact with me. They wouldn't really make eye contact with him. There were times when it was so overt, I had to ask for a beverage refill for him because they wouldn't acknowledge. And I mean, in the South, there were some places where it was so incredibly overt. But then even in the North, I recognize it. And I tell this story in Minneapolis. I have an old pickup truck. I've had it for a very long time. I had to retire it about a couple years ago and get another old pickup truck. But I drove that around North Minneapolis for 10, 12 years. Not one time was I pulled over by the police for anything. I have a couple of African-American brothers, neighbors that were, you know, partners, community members in ministry together. And they would borrow it because they need to go get a couch or go pick up something or go make a run to the dump or something. So I let them borrow it. And at least 50% of the time, they were pulled over by the police. And not once got a ticket. But and for things like, I remember my brother coming back one time and he's like, yeah, I got pulled over in your truck again. Sorry about that. And I was like, for what? And he goes, well, the cop said your license plate lights are out.
Wow.
And I was like, I have license plate lights? Like, I didn't even know that was a thing. Oh, but I've been driving it around like that in the dark for a decade plus. And so I started seeing that I love these brothers. I trust these brothers. Either there is flaws in the system and I do benefit because of whiteness, or they aren't trustworthy. I had to go with Well, but I know them. I love them. I trust them. They love the Lord. I've ridden with them. They're not doing anything crazy. So I have to thus conclude that my whiteness does separate me in some way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And so then you start looking around. Yeah. And you start noticing, oh, well, there's a little one. Oh, there's a little one. Oh, there's a little one. And it mm-hmm. gradually kind of builds, and you start to recognize that bubble that you're in kind of everywhere. Mm-hmm. Become hypersensitive to it.
So this is really interesting, because on a regular life basis, there are reminders that you have started to see now. Right. You've grown antenna for that. But then you're connected with people who are also white, who have no ability to see any of that. What's it like for you interacting with white folks that don't see their whiteness or don't see the kinds of things you're talking about?
That's probably the hardest thing that I deal with, and has been the cause of more heartbreak than even, and I don't know, I'm trying to think, you know, what is more damaging to my soul? What is happening in society right now in my neighborhood, the uptick in violence, the social injustice that I see, or the interactions with white folks that I consistently have in my life, community, family, that kind of refuse to acknowledge that that's true or that any of that is real. Yes. And I think my own heart has been damaged by that, because the message that it does send is, I trust my own experience. I trust what I kind of see out here where I live, or what I see on the news or by my favorite political news commentators, more than I trust you, more than I trust your experience and your interpretation of what you're seeing. And so it's very damaging, I think, to me. And I've had to deal with some of that emotional stuff over the course of the last 25 years. An attempt to get some healing from it, attempt to separate myself when I need to from it. But it's incredibly difficult to interact with, because we're reading two different books and attempting to compare them. We have to be bilingual, right? Which is different than code switching, because I can code switch with the best of them because I grew up in suburban white middle class society, and I can speak suburban white middle class. It's a language. I've been in predominantly places of color for the last 25 years, and I can code switch and kind of fit in and speak fluently in that. But translating what I see from where I live and who my neighbors are and my brothers and sisters in ministry now, translating that into suburban white middle class ease, I have yet to find an effective Babbel app for that.
I wonder if part of it is sometimes when you go across cultures, that not speaking the language actually can provide a little bit of safety, in the sense that the translator creates the environment for you, right? But when you actually understand the language, sometimes you realize that what the other person's saying is startling, unsettling. I almost wonder if part of what you're talking about is, to the extent that you can make yourself plainly understood within the environment that you grew up in, that's not welcome, right? That's startling. So it's not just a question of, can you be understood? It's a question of, do the recipients of your communication, do your dialogue partners want to understand what you're saying?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I know 100% that there is not a receptivity to some of the things that I know to be true because of my proximity, because they will come back with an example of how it's not true, even if that example is deeply flawed. I look at it almost, there's a scientific argument, right, of the science versus God. And you have on one side of a scientific argument, we're starting with the fact that there is a divine being. And then I'm going to go into nature and into science and all these things, and it's going to be influenced by the fact that there is a divine being. And so everywhere I look in nature, every system that I see, I am going to curse kind of Darwin and the theory of evolution and those things, because that's not how it happened. It's Genesis. And I'm going to look for all of the evidence that can support that. Right. And on the other side, there, you know, the whole group of scientists that say there is no divine being, and they're too starting with a presupposition. And so everything that they go into is finding evidence that will support the fact that there is no God, and it's only science and all of these things. And that's not even scientific, right? Like the scientific method says you can't start with a presupposition. Right. but we all do. And so with the conversation with whiteness and intercultural competency, all of these things, it is very, very difficult, I have found, to come in and try and interject truth and fact into a place where someone is going to take what I've said and go and find the facts because they know it not to be true. So they're going to go find the facts that do prove their point rather than being open and willing to understand or willing to listen or willing to think about that other version of history, of society, of economics, of politics, of anything. And so, and I don't think our political environment has done us any favors either, as everything seemingly has become very political and the sides continue to diverge further and further and be entrenched in that.
Why is it important to you to have that conversation?
That's a great question because, I mean, I would say even recently, because of a lot of recent events, I have wrestled with that. And I have wrestled with the fact, is it just time to be done? Mm. I have looked back at conversations with my own family in the last month and said, it's not worth it. Mm. I am just not going to, at worst, not get together with my family anymore, which I don't want to do. But even at best, go, I'm going to be quiet. Because it's not worth it, because it's painful. Because I think those of us on this side of some of those discussions, recognizing our whiteness, looking back at whiteness constructively and saying, no, it's a thing and we might need to do some dismantling. It's not all bad. There's some really good things about it as well. How do we use it for the benefit of our community? How do I exploit my whiteness on behalf of my brothers and sisters of color so that I can be of some earthly good here?
I think this conversation can be uncomfortable for a lot of people because the minute that you bring up a topic on whiteness, it can probably go in a couple of directions, right? It can sound threatening to folks because in some ways, maybe it sounds like we're singling out white folks in another privileged way by reflecting on it, or it can feel threatening as if to be white is somehow inherently bad. Mm. Right. So how are you processing through just some of our conversation today about whiteness and trying to navigate maybe some of those tensions too?
So something that I don't know, I mean, I almost feel embarrassed by this, but I remember it really wasn't until I was in grad school that I realized I was white. So I was in my master's in intercultural relations. I had a bachelor's in intercultural studies, right? and international business, right? It just seems like somewhere along the way, I should have probably wrestled with the idea of whiteness. And I somehow got into my master's before I really confronted the idea that I was part of this group that wasn't just normal, right? Because that's the, I think that's the alternative generally for white folks that don't know that we're white is we think of ourselves as normal and then everybody else is hyphenated, you know, African-Americans, Asian-Americans, you know, like we have this sense of Mexican-Americans, whatever, you know, everybody's hyphenated, but I'm normal. And I remember one of my classmates was a Black woman and she was just so confused that there were several of us white folks in that class that had never thought about our whiteness before. She's like, how could you possibly not know? Hmm. Like, it just didn't make any sense to her at all, which now I get it why that was the case.
Yeah.
And I do think there are a few things that go with that. One is, I think that there is the need to, on the one hand, be gracious with our fellow white people, because I think it is literally possible to go through the world and not really understand your whiteness. I think maybe that's becoming a little bit less possible. And I think that's some of the tension that we're feeling. Mm. But I think it's generally pretty possible as a white person to think of yourself as normal and not as part of this experience of whiteness. So there's a need to kind of be, on the one hand, gracious with people because they literally don't know. And on the other hand, I think there is a need to have the conversation because the assumption of normalness, right? When it becomes normative, when I am the way of being in the world and you are something different from that, oh gosh, like there are terrible fruit from that tree.
Yeah.
That's something I'm just thinking about. It just kind of reflected on some of my own journey.
Well, and there's even a difference between comprehending and understanding that you're white and what whiteness is, and then actually discovering what that means on a daily basis. And that's the more complicated question. That's something I wonder for myself if I've only begun to scratch the surface on, if I'm honest with myself. I can't say that I've been on this journey where I've done a lot of hard wrestling with the concept of what it means to be white, even though I will fully acknowledge I'm white. I know that what whiteness is. I understand some of the ways that that's impacted my life. And yet at the same time, there's a lot of ways I don't know if I have fully realized it.
In some ways, these are like at the very basic level of, do you acknowledge that your whiteness exists and that it matters in your experience of the world? You know,
yeah.
And then there are much more complicated conversations that happen later, you know, with what do you do with that? But I don't know. This episode is interesting to me because we had one of our grads wrote and asked, hey, could you guys talk about whiteness and like, what does it mean to talk with other white people about issues of race? And I don't know that we've like solved anything here.
No.
The other thing that I'm thinking about is somebody had written recently about being tired of being basically the coach for white people, right? Yeah. Have you seen this?
I've heard similar things. Yeah. To me, there's this tension though, isn't there? Because sometimes I feel a little uncomfortable when I know of organizations and stuff that are having conversations about racial equality and anti-racism and all of this. And basically they're hiring white people to teach on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that white people can't speak to that and that there can't be white people who know things about it that are very helpful in training for training purposes. But and again, you don't want to tokenize anybody in saying, well, you're black, so you somehow now should be the one to speak on it. On the other hand, there is something that I think a black person will bring to the conversation that just simply cannot be fully present when it's just a bunch of white people trying to train other white people on the perspectives and on the experiences of non-white folks. You know, whether if it's a person who's black or Hispanic or you name it, right? And so in some ways, I feel that tension, right? Of like, you don't want to say, well, yeah, it's black folks' responsibility to fix white people's prejudices and problems. On the other hand, I feel like it's also a little counterproductive when you have a bunch of white people who decide, let's find the white experts on this. Mm-hmm. You know, so what? I don't know what the answer is, but it seems like the tension is maybe the answer, right? But it seems like there's got to be a way that's avoiding kind of both of those dangers, right?
Well, or maybe it's just something that we walk in both of those realities at the same time. So I've seen a few things recently about this idea that white supremacy is a white issue and we need to address it, right? And white supremacy, again, might sound like harsh language, you know, but this idea that white privilege and underneath that, there is generally this foundation of white supremacy, right? When you make whiteness normative, that is effectively an exercise of saying that this is the right way of being in the world. Anyway, all of that, that it's incumbent on white folks to press into it and that we need to be having those conversations internally as white folks in fellowship with, in conversation with people of color, right? We need to be following the leadership of people of color. So it's not like it's to the exclusion of those other relationships, but I'm just thinking about a conversation like this, where it's three white guys talking about whiteness. Like actually that is something we need to be doing is wrestling with it internally. Cause this is an issue that we have and we can't push that off. It doesn't make sense to push that off on somebody else and say, hey, you solve that for us and get back to us when you got to figure it out.
At the same time, there's some significant limitations to those conversations. And it's why it's necessary to not have those conversations be the only thing that's happening.
Agreed.
Right? It's kind of like, I don't want to diminish the conversation by moving in this direction, but it's like if an organization discovers problems within their organization and they only try to solve it internally without, sometimes you got to get the external help to bring in perspectives and things that nobody in the actual organization is seeing. You know what I mean? And so it's like, there's that aspect to it where it's like, sometimes we're so blinded by our own experiences that we wouldn't be able to see beyond it without being shown differently.
I think that's a great point. I think it's kind of like you bring in the external consultant, but then, so an organization brings in an external consultant, but then the organization has to choose to do the work.
For sure.
And I think that that is maybe where some people who have been serving in roles of consultants for predominantly white organizations or others have said, you know, you've brought me in as a consultant, you could bring me in 10 years from now as a consultant and nothing will have changed because you're not doing the work. And I think that's the issue that we have to actually press in.
And one thing I've noticed is that there can be this tendency of once you have that sort of consultant brought in is to say, well, we've done the work now.
Exactly. And that's not the work.
It's like, well, we had somebody come.
That's the diagnosis, right?
Yeah,
and maybe
that's
just the first diagnosis of saying, you might want to get that looked at. Right. Yeah. It's like, you know, you drive your car into the mechanic and, you know, you got smoke coming out the back end of it. Right. And the mechanic's like, yeah, you probably want to get that looked at. And we're like, okay, well, I've done the work.
I went to the mechanic today. Same thing with the doctor.
It's like, you don't even know what's wrong yet. Right. It's just like, it's not good when there's smoke coming out the back.
Or worse off, you go to the doctor and they tell you what's wrong. But then you're like, well, I went to the doctor and he told me, you know, and it's like, yeah, but you take the medication? Did you, you know, did you get the surgery? Did you, you know what I mean?
And then there's the whole rehabilitation process afterwards, right? It's like,
That's the problem. And especially in areas of, I think, predominantly white organizations that are dealing with questions of diversity and race and racial justice, there is this major danger of having a consultant come in and feeling good about yourself as an organization and then just saying, well, we did it.
Listen to how clumsy we are talking about this. And we talk about this, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I feel like we're just stumbling over our words all the time. And, of course. And we actually talk about this on a pretty regular basis. And I think, our capacity to actually do good work in this is so small and we have to develop that capacity. I think this conversation with John is good practice and it's not necessarily satisfying. It's like you go to the gym and you come away from it. So you go and you lift once and you're like, hey, you feel all jacked, but then you look in the mirror and it's like nothing's happened, you know? And I think that in some ways, this is also that kind of thing. It's like, no, we got to keep practicing and practicing and practicing. And when you slowly see change happen.
I feel like a lot of these conversations we've been having with all of our guests, I've been super encouraged by, challenged by, and I feel awkward with every one of them feeling like I know there's parts we're missing. I know we're fumbling over our thoughts and our words, and we're trying to be both upfront about reflections that we've had on these things, but at the same time wanting to be cautious not to overstate things that we are just discovering ourselves, not to claim to be experts on things that we may not be. At the same time, to understand that like we're not trying to have this platform here that's trying to shove ideas down people's throats either. Like I think we want to have the conversation, but we want to do so in a way that's balanced, that's sensitive, and that's also hopefully bringing in some insight. But all of this, see, even just foaming over this makes me go, see, like these are conversations that aren't easy to have.
Thank you for joining us for episode 17 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. We will present the second half of our conversation with John in episode 18. For show notes or to contribute to production costs, visit profsinrooms.com. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. Lindsay Zell was the editing assistant for this episode. We hope you can join us for coffee again next week.